Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of a current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 3ZZZ Radio in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show,
women are always cutting short their careers or putting their careers on hold to have that family, and therefore when they're not earning, they're not receiving the super.
The Australian government set to pay superannuation on paid parental leave. South Australia's Indigenous community votes for state's inaugural voice to parliament election. And later today,
Not just suggest that they might want to join a park run, but actually sort of provide them the support to actually go and attend a park run, so somebody goes with them.
Are doctors prescribing runs instead of pills now? We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. The Australian government announced it will pay superannuation on the government-funded paid parental leave from July 1st of 2025. The announcement comes alongside the release of Australia's first national strategy to achieve gender equality. Paying super on paid parental is a key recommendation of Women's Economic Equality Task Force. The Wire's Netta Finney starts this report speaking to a new mum currently on parental leave.
My name's Holstein Wong and I'm a sales account manager in a technology company.
What changed in your life after having a baby?
Oh, having a baby was the most wonderful thing for me and my partner. Our baby is 7 months old now and he is such a delight. He smiles with his whole face and yeah, he's just such a bright addition to our family.
And you took paid parental leave, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So between the two of us, we got the 20 weeks of paid parental leave from the government.
You're taking turns staying at home looking after Bob?
Yes, that's right. So I've been at home with Bob for 7 months and my husband will then take the next 3 months off. So it's great that we're able to share the care between the two of us.
You weren't paid super for your parental leave, right?
No, there was no super for the government paid parental leave.
What difference would it have made to have that super paid along with your paid parental leave?
That would have made a huge difference in terms of normalising paid parental leave, making it the same as like taking annual leave or long service leave, I suppose, making it more normal for both parents to take time off, because babies are fantastic, but care work is hard work and it's really great to be able to be acknowledged for that.
So what else would you like to see the government do to financially support parents?
The government extending the parental leave program is a really good step, and the really biggest thing for us now looking forward is more affordable childcare. We both want to be able to make sure that baby gets well looked after, but also we want to go back to work as well, and we're trying to rebalance that, the family moving forward. I'm very grateful that my partner can take time off to spend time with the baby. He's very excited as well. They're really looking forward to having their time together. It's not going to be a holiday. It's going to be hard work as well, but I think it's going to be really important for their bonding. And yeah, it would just be really great to see society as a whole normalise parental leave for dads, for both parents, because there's lots of benefits for everybody.
Karen Lindsay is an accountant and the founder of Financial Superwoman, an educational money workshop program. Karen shares with us why she thinks super being paid on paid parental leave has taken so long and why it's important for women.
The government haven't had the foresight or the information to see what's going on. You know, in reality, women are always cutting short their careers or putting their careers on hold to have that family, and therefore when they're not earning, they're not receiving the super. So I guess there is an element of sexism there. It's been long needed, most definitely.
What do you think this change was needed?
There are so many women that we come across. We meet them at our workshops where they have a lot less super than their husbands or spouses. And in that separation process, they miss out. There's just, it's really hard for them to get equality and for them to be recognised that they contribute to the household by raising the family or the children and supporting the husband or the ex-spouse. Left a lot less funds to support them moving forward. And that's one element. And then the other element is just the financial abuse that we see for the woman who attend our workshops, where they've had their funds cut off or just not given any opportunity to have any opinion on the household funds, and terrible financial abuse. And therefore, they just to have the super component paid for while they're on paid parental leave is definitely a benefit, probably not the biggest contribution that can happen from the government, but it's a step in the right direction.
The government themselves had said that women on average retire with about 25% less super than men. Do you think that this policy will help even that up? And if not, what else is needed to achieve economic equality?
It is a contribution to even it up. I don't believe it will completely even it up, but the paid parental leave only covers a limited amount of weeks. And so often the woman stays at home longer than that, and therefore they're not receiving benefits, you know, or financial contribution to cover all of that. So therefore it won't even up the financial situation between the males and the females.
What else do you think is needed to support women to be more equal financially to men?
Longer paid parental leave support for the time that they are out of the workforce. And then it just comes back to the equality across careers. We've seen time and time again, men and women doing the same role, having the same experience, but we've seen the stats where the women are paid less than the men. And that's part of that equality argument, isn't it? It's great that it's finally coming into play. It's a shame it hasn't happened before, but I guess the government moving in the right direction, but they've still got further to go to have that equality between men and women.
That was accountant and founder of Financial Superwoman, Karen Lindsay, speaking with The Wire's Netta Finney. Indigenous South Australians will head to the polls on the weekend for the state's first Voice to Parliament election. The state government has committed to implementing the Uluru Statement from the Heart, an agreement which also sparked the National Voice to Parliament referendum last year. Greens Senator and Indigenous Affairs spokesperson Dorinda Cox says this weekend signals a crucial step forward for Indigenous peoples achieving self-determination. Community Radio Network's political correspondent Noah Sacombe reports from Canberra.
The South Australian state-level voice is the first of its kind in this country. However, the process to introduce the South Australian voice has been delayed for 6 months to avoid confusion in the midst of the national referendum to enshrine a federal voice in the Constitution in October of last year. Unlike the federal voice referendum, the South Australian voice to Parliament has already been legislated. It's now up to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the state to vote for who they want to represent them at a local and state level. Greens Senator Dorinda Cox was in South Australia recently, and she says reaction on the ground is optimistic.
It was really a strong focus, like people really like invigorated and talking about it and how great they were and their campaigns. And I was like, wow, this is exciting. I feel like I'm in an election where I am, you know, I'm in an election of my own people. Really, like, sort of strikes a chord in me because I really think that we're coming to a pivotal time. We have 11 First Nations parliamentarians in federal parliament, and we are seeing a state-based voice ignite a real passion for politics and really wanting people to be engaged and involved in it. And just the diversity of people. I know that there are something like 40-odd candidates just in one area in some central Ghana region. And I think that what that shows is that whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're a young person, an older person, you're engaged now in the political sense of what South Australian voice can deliver and should deliver. And I think that level of accountability by our own community will be really, really important.
Over 100 people have nominated to stand as candidates across six new electoral constituencies. 46 positions are up for grabs. 11 will represent the Central Adelaide voice and 7 will represent each of the 5 remaining regional areas. However, the voice election has raised concerns over accurate representation as the voting regions don't follow the boundaries of First Nations clans or language groups.
There's so much difference, right? Like if we go back to not just borders, but the naming of places, it's really fundamental for us to have ownership of what those cultural boundaries are and language groups and clan groups and tribal boundaries. We can filter that upwards. And I think that, and that's the point I make about I don't think they're going to get it right first time. I think there's going to be adjustment, there's going to be teething problems in that because we are trying to fit a very cultural process about speaking in the right way and speaking for and to people into a very white democratic system. the ability to be and represent in an electorate is very unique to being all things for all people. And so quite often you'll hear us as parliamentarians say, I also represent the broader public. You know, I represent the state of Western Australia that has so much diversity in it. And, you know, less than 4% of that population is First Nations people, yet I'm the national spokes for my party. So there's these tensions of your identity and who you are and where you come from and your voice and agency that you try and maintain versus a white democratic system which will push you into a... It's almost like this box of, no, but you only need to speak for these people or on these issues. And so it's a real struggle. It's an internal struggle for us. And I'm hoping that candidates that are currently putting their hand up for the Voice elections are taking that into consideration and are going to be able to get into that space and really work together, because we're going to get that done much quicker.
Senator Cox says she's hopeful to see action from other state and territory leaders to follow South Australia's lead.
You know, we have Labor governments wall-to-wall on the mainland, and so I think that there's definitely an opportunity for us to do this in all states and territories. But it takes the will of the state government to be able to do that.
Whether the state voice can change attitudes towards Indigenous representation at a federal level is also yet to be seen.
I think it's pivotal that the success of SA, the continuation of the work in Victoria, should spread to, like, even my home state of Western Australia and Queensland, who were some of the highest no votes in the country, that we could really bring a lot of attention to this can work if we work with state parliaments, we work with local communities, we co-design and co-implement a process that mob can really own and see themselves being part of. And
that was Community Radio Network's political correspondent Noah Saccombe speaking to Dorinda Cox, Greens Senator and Indigenous Affairs spokesperson. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mamina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Amrita Goikar lost her brother in a drowning incident at a beach in Victoria 7 years ago during a family holiday. Since this incident, Amrita has co-founded the Himant Goikar Foundation to spread the awareness of water and swimming safety. Amrita is recording this at the same beach where her brother passed away.
It was just a few seconds. I thought he was going to swim around to those two guys who were already in the water for a long time. Suddenly the waves turned very strong. I thought he was going to save those two guys. And later we just couldn't see him anymore. I thought he would be there back with us in a few seconds. But we couldn't spot him. And me and my husband started shouting his name loudly. The police came, and after a long, long time, they managed to get the water boat. And it was then getting a little bit darker. The police told us that we all had to go home, that the search will continue the next day. The search was going on for many days, and still nothing was found. And I realized, oh my God, my brother is not going to come back to me anymore. Why did we choose that day? Life was really beautiful. It was so amazing day. So many things we were looking forward to do next. I was completely lost.
We now speak to Stacey Pidgeon, who's the National Manager for Research and Policy in Royal Life Saving Society. Stacey, it seems that a quarter of the drowning deaths happened within the week of Christmas and New Year, the time that is supposed to be for the time with family and relaxation.
It is very sad. It's a time when people should be celebrating or relaxing with family and friends. And it is sort of that 1 week is quite shocking that over a quarter of all drowning deaths over the summer happened within that 1 week. So we do think people are a little bit complacent. They're very relaxed. They're on holiday, in holiday mode. Lots of people around. So maybe people aren't watching the kids as much as they should be. You know, again, alcohol plays a part in that as well. And so, yeah, that is a very, very sad time. And we just think that people aren't paying as much attention as what they should be during that time. So, yeah, unfortunately, we have seen an increase in drowning over that period.
With the multicultural communities, do you think one of the reasons could be because they are not used to the sea conditions? They haven't been near a sea, like, you know, the visitors especially?
Sometimes, yeah, we do know that sometimes people come from countries where they've had no experience. And then also people also come from countries where they have been swimming in rivers and lakes. But when they come to Australia, the conditions are very different. So they do have experience, but that experience doesn't necessarily translate when they come to Australia, and the environment is very different as well. And so really just thinking about or being aware of people's limitations and their own abilities.
It was very surprising to see that about 26% of the people that who drowned were 55 years or over, whereas we think it's usually the kids or, you know, some people who don't know. So I was just surprised. Why have you had a look into that as to, are these the people who don't know swimming or is it some other reason?
The older age group is quite concerning for us, actually. And so actually over the last 20 years, we've seen a slow increase in older people drowning. As you've mentioned, I think lots of people think about drowning of young kids or teenagers or even young people, and we don't really think about older people so much. Sometimes can be around knowledge and attitudes and behaviour, sort of, it's not going to happen to me. Some people think they've still got the fitness of when they were much younger and can still swim or can do those types of things, whereas sometimes they don't realise that their body has become, I guess, a little bit more frail perhaps, or just don't have the same levels of fitness as what they did 20 years ago. And also for some people it might be as well, you know, going to the same locations year in and year out, which is great, but obviously conditions do change all the time as well. You know, there might be the last few years, there's been a lot more water around, and rivers that have been previously dry or low have now got a lot more water in them, which means a lot more movement of debris and trees and rocks, and the depth has changed and all those types of things. And unfortunately, we do see behaviour like not wearing life jackets quite common as well among older people. And sometimes alcohol also has a role to play as well, unfortunately. Well, we certainly, you know, want to see people have fun and enjoy the water safely. But over the summer period, we were pushing out our key messages, so making sure that people always, we want people to be actively watching children being an arm's length away. So if anything does happen, you can be within reach if something does happen, and certainly not leaving siblings to watch young children around the water either. We're also pushing that everyone should be wearing a life jacket when they're out on the water, particularly when boating, fishing, and, you know, and paddling as well, not going alone. We know that quite a few people are by themselves when something happens, so there's no one to help them. So we really want to make sure that you go with a friend or someone else, because just in case something happens, water and alcohol just simply don't mix, and also checking the conditions as well.
That was Renu Tiwari speaking to Stacey Pidgeon from the Royal Life Saving Society. More people are now looking at alternative ways of healing besides medication. A phenomenon called social prescribing is a prescription for things beyond medicine, like going for a walk or getting help with finances to improve health. This approach is gaining support worldwide, focusing on individual needs and building community connections for better health. I speak to Sian Slade from the University of Melbourne about social prescribing.
I suppose this is not about medicalising something that doesn't need to be medicalised, but it's starting to, quite often people might go and see a GP about something and they trust a GP, and it's a situation that they can have a confidential conversation. And I think sometimes it helps when you're talking to someone who's a medical professional who's got an oversight of what's happening with you. And so that's a very particular situation. But I guess what social prescribing is not trying to do, it's not trying to sort of medicalise for everybody. It's basically saying for those people who can go to the gym and do this and, you know, organise themselves, that's perfect. But what it is saying is for those people who need some extra support, this might be an avenue that sort of really not just suggests that they might want to join a park run, but actually sort of provides them the support to actually go and attend a park run. So somebody goes with them. And so it creates that much more warmer referral than just relying on someone who, you know, might say, well, I haven't got the confidence to go because I won't know anybody. So it's really that piece of just helping people with that next step, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And how has the concept of social prescribing gained such momentum globally?
Well, do you know what? I think it's because it's sort of common sense, really. I sort of get the feeling, perhaps a bit like you just said, I think it's what we should be doing in many ways. And I don't know, I just think everyone thinks it's just such a common sense approach that why wouldn't we be doing it? So I think that's why it's really gained traction in terms of what it is, and sort of, I think it offers everyday people, including, you know, you and I, this opportunity to be much more, empowered of our own healthcare, and sort of that we do have an opportunity to do something about it, and we do know that exercise is good for you. And, you know, most of us possibly can go out and go for a walk. Some people can't. Some people need some extra help to be able to do so. Some people may, you know, not feel confident enough. So it's understanding who are those people that would benefit but need a bit of extra help. And I think that's where it's come in. So I think it's almost like it's bridging a bit of an opportunity, if you like, and sort of enabling that to happen. So I think that's why I think it's taken off. I think there's an interest. But don't forget also, it's still at pretty early stages in Australia. So there's lots of different activities that are happening in lots of different places, and that's great because it's based on needs locally. And I think our opportunity now is not to stop all the wonderful stuff that's going on, but it's to start to understand, well, what works for who in different places and how can we learn from people?
As you mentioned, it's something that's new in Australia, but what are some of the challenges with social prescribing, especially, I guess, in the Australian healthcare system?
I think partly just sort of connecting things up. So I think if we structurally sort of, we have a health and aged care system, we have a social system, so some of the structures, if you like, are separated at the moment. And I think the opportunity then for social prescribing is to provide something that bridges across these structures so that we recognise the opportunity for people to keep themselves well, and sort of that focus on wellbeing and prevention, and understanding then the supports that are required if people need sort of more clinical interventions. So I think it's changing in answer to your question. And I think this is an example of something that's helping bridge some of those structural approaches to start to say, how can we really focus on person-centred care?
And will we see the Australian healthcare system start embracing social prescribing?
They already are. So certainly I was at an event at Melbourne Uni last year where Mark Butler was talking about social prescribing. It's in several policy documents like the Primary Care 10-Year Plan. It's in the National Preventive Health Strategy. At state level, it's in various state policy documents, and in fact happening in local connections through Mental Health and Wellbeing Victoria. So there's lots of activity that is currently happening. But as I say, you know, it's quite early stages at this point in time, and I think the opportunity is, how do we build that sort of evidence base, understand what works for who, where, and how can we do it together? I think that's the other key thing with all this, Molina, is how do we work together to do these things? This is not about doing something to someone. This is about working with people based on a conversation with what matters to you, and really sort of thinking through what would help you get to the next step of that health and wellbeing journey.
That was Sian Slade from the University of Melbourne speaking to The Wire. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 3ZZZ in Melbourne, 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Y acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Kulin Nations where the program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Mamina Shakura coming to you from 3ZZZ Radio in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.